All right, everybody, what's going on? This is Marvin Sports and Life, episode 91. I'm coming with y'all with the resurrection episode. I'm gonna call this the resurrection episode with the Dr. Josh Myers, Orangeburg native, a OW alum, a Bruin, a running back, Josh has been on to do mighty great things in the field of education. Also, is an author of two books. If you guys look in the episode, if you look in the title above, if you're on Facebook, you look above, you can see the copy, you can see the name of the books. And if you're on YouTube, you can check below, you see the copy of the books. And if you also listen to this on any of the audio podcast, you guys can look at the description and you can look at the books in the description. And you guys go check it out. So, Josh, how you doing, man?
I'm doing well, brother. How about you?
Man, I'm doing pretty good, man. Josh, I know to see what you're doing. But first, before we go any further, you already know what I'm about to come with you in.
Yeah.
Josh is the author of my butter pecan, my butter pecan ice cream sandwiches. They got clipped and got shared by the shade room and all these people. This is the guy responsible for it. He ate that, and then somebody else took it, and it just went crazy. This is the guy responsible for my butter pecan ice cream sandwiches going viral.
That's hilarious, man.
That video went, that clip, man, it still comes up.
That's crazy. Because, you know, man, I was just, you know, shooting the shit a little bit, man, on Twitter.
Yeah.
And, you know, I saw this on Facebook, and I was like, wow, butter pecan sandwich ice cream. Only in the South.
Only in the South. You know, and everybody else thought the same thing also, because they took it, share, and it went crazy.
Yeah.
So we got that in the way. So, Josh, we want to start back. And to be fair, I'm going to tell you right now, guys, to be fair, I know this guy. Me and the guy go back. We not sweat together on the football field. We not did up, down, crabbing.
Yep.
All that stuff. So
you played tackle or guard? I can't remember right now.
Guard.
All right. So, you know, that K3 and K4, man.
That's it. Shout out to all the fat boys who know that language. The fat boys and the running backs know that language. So that's thought back. So if somebody had to describe you, what kind of child would they say you were, like, elementary school?
Oh, wow. Elementary school taking me all the way back. You know, so I was always reading, I think.
Okay.
And that would have probably been the initial thing that people would have noticed about me. I remember in first grade, my first grade teacher was giving me third and fourth grade books. And so I started reading on that level relatively early. And it's really because I would say the Child Development Center at Greater Faith Baptist Church, they really started us learning to read 2 years old, 3 years old. So by the time I got to elementary school, I was already there.
Wow.
And so, yeah, shout out to Greater Faith because, you know.
They still good.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And so that might be the first thing that people might say about me. But I was very much into sports too. I still remember also in first grade, you know, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I remember my response, point guard for the Chicago Bulls. It was clear. and so I was into my basketball was my first love, and that was where what I was thinking about half of the time when I was in elementary school. Football and baseball too, but really basketball. I can just remember, like, it was homework and then going outside. Homework, going outside, homework, going outside. It's an endless cycle of that. And then by the time I got to, I guess it was first organized basketball was fourth grade. Actually, shout out to people like Donald Kears and Jay Robinson, and of course, my teammate Rod Fields, who actually went pro. Right?
Sure.
I think it was on the Orlando Magic back in like
shout out Rod Fields.
96 or 97.
Uh-huh.
And so that's an indelible memory is how Central sports were as we were growing up. But also there was an emphasis on academics that was real too. And of course, spirituality and religion. All of those things are like cardinal features of growing up in Orangeburg.
Yeah. Okay. So you're smart. So because I correct us on far as you went to Felton?
So I grew up in first 5 years in Orangeburg. That's when I went to Greater Faith.
Okay.
Then we moved for the first 3 years of elementary school. My dad went to get his PhD at the University of Georgia. So the whole family moved to Athens.
Okay.
Yeah, I came back in fourth grade and I went to Marshall Elementary.
So, what middle school you went to?
Which
what? What middle school did you go to?
Then I went to Clark. Yeah.
Oh, you was on Clark A or Clark B?
Clark, or in football, I was on. It's a good question. Football, I think it was Clark B.
Okay.
And then basketball, we were on Clark A.
Okay. Because one thing, I'll tell somebody about this, so you probably, because you know, it's a Clark, so I'm pretty sure you're using the magnet program at Clark.
Yep.
I told somebody at Clark, we had to have I see people have these extremism. At Clark, we probably had to have the most, the most hoodest, smartest kids I've ever met in my life. If that makes sense? You the man of the program, shout out to EJ. EJ was in it for a little bit, I think. But like, y'all guys, like, people have these stories, sometimes they almost like equate, I'm pretty sure you can speak to this, even though it might be out of, I'm not gonna say idiocracy, just people just being ignorant. Sometimes they equate being smart or not being in touch sometimes or not being as relatable.
Right.
But at Clark, even though we all just kids are a magnet program,
mm-hmm. We had no choice but to be in touch with people. Right? I can remember it. So now that I have the language for going through like studying and stuff, we were actually being tracked. It was called educational tracking.
Okay.
And so they would have a track for people who are so-called gifted and talented. Then they would have a so-called regular track, and then they would have the track for people who needed extra attention, or the so-called remedial track, right? And there's like three or four of them at Clark. I can remember to this day because I had friends in elementary school that got tracked into the other tracks. And so I never saw them as much, right? Because we were taking the same classes, right? And so the only time we would come back together was on the athletics field. Or
Yep. Court.
And so that's really where those friendships got a chance to really come back together because of the fact that we were being tracked educationally. But at the same time, you're right. Like, socioeconomic class wasn't an indicator of the track. It was a difference. So yeah, absolutely.
But I think, and I also think, I tell some people growing up in Orangeburg, even I talked to everybody about this, even shout out to Rob Fields. You just brought your teammate, even Rob Fields, on there. Rob's an Edinburgh now professional basketball player. I was talking to even Davey, who's on his side. This is a whole bunch of OW love, who's on the Survivor show. And everybody has the same story. I don't care where they're going. Like, I don't care if they go to Japan. They said growing up in Orangeburg has just prepared them to, like, be so adaptive to so many other places that they would never thought, like, they're growing up in this little small town. Mm-hmm. But make you be able to adapt and move so fluently in these larger markets.
It's true. But also, like, Orangeburg is like a microcosm of so many other places in the world at the same time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you talk about Black folk, right? Most Black folk, you know, over time and space are rural peoples, right? And so, you know, the notion that we would be able to relate to Black people or just people in a sense, wherever we are, is rooted in the fact that a lot of what our identity is kind of grounded in is mm-hmm. something that Black folk share. It's like a commitment to brotherhood, sisterhood, kinship, community. Everywhere we go, we treat people as if that's like that's our cousin, right? Okay. I mean, is that relatability? And in order to kind of make it in Orangeburg, you got to have that. You got to have that right. sense.
You better. It will eat you up.
Yeah.
You better. It's definitely going to eat you up. So yeah. That is right. So you did go to middle school with us. So you go to middle school. At this time, so you're playing ball, even at middle school, has it dawned on you like, I know you're in the magnet program, but is it dawned on you like in middle school, because of course in elementary school you want to be the starting point guard for the Chicago Bulls. So right. So when you get to middle school, and I guess you're taking education more seriously. I say cereal, my gosh. So does your what you wanted to be because at this time you're not Dr. Josh Amaji yet. Are you kind of figuring out what you might want to be? Or are you kind of you're still not sure yet?
Nah, brother, it got worse in middle school. Meaning, we thought we were going to the NBA, like straight up, right? And so I grew up in Bonneville, so we had all the ballers. We had Reggie Coleman, James Ross, like older heads. And that then is. You know what we would do every day, especially during the summer, is that we would play basketball. Until we couldn't play basketball anymore. Mm-hmm. Everybody played, right? So, I mean, everybody from Black Rod, Robert Jameson, Jay Green, Jonathan Green. I mean, most people don't know that Jay Green could ball, right? Unless you know Jay Green, right?
Nah, man. Shout out Jay Green. Jay Green grew up be like us. He was a fat boy on the O-line.
Yes,
shout out Jay Green. But Jay Green you get free too, brother?
And so, I mean, this is like part of like, you know, Chris Frederick, Roddy Wilkes, my brother, Chris Myers, like Chris Curry, my next door neighbor. I mean, every house that had a boy, we balled.
Yeah. Right?
And so by the time I'm in seventh grade, it's looking like, all right, I made AAU, right? The AAU team.
Okay.
James Ross, of course, is on varsity with OW and we're balling, we're playing together, right? And, you know, the thinking was, all I got to do is get better every year, right? By eighth grade, ninth grade, I'll be on JV. 10th grade, I'll be on varsity.
Yeah.
And then it's like, all right, we're going to the NBA. Like, that was going D1, and then we going to the NBA. And so it never really started becoming less of a dream until I realized I wasn't about to grow to be 6'4", even though, you know, my nickname was Rabbit because I could jump. You know, my first dunk was in eighth grade, right? But when I realized I wasn't going to be 6'5", 6'6", right, by the time I get to ninth grade, it's like that's when the thing switched more to football because I never played football. I didn't play Little League football. I didn't play, like, you know, for the city. My first football was eighth grade. Coach Walker was like, come be the quarterback for the team. And I'm like, no, I'm a basketball player. And so they convinced me to be the quarterback for Clark B, I think it was. I lasted one practice as the quarterback, and they moved me to running back. And that's my brother Tronny became quarterback, right? You remember Tronny?
And shout out to Tronny, because Tronny had Clark B rocking.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's how that whole thing happened. And then Coach Walker is like, of course, the coach for OWB team was like, are you going to keep playing? Right. And so then I met Coach Brown. And that's like, all right, who is not inspired by the work that Coach Brown was doing? I mean, it was hard, but it was also like, yeah, let's go. Let's go. And so I never played basketball past ninth grade. It was football from then on.
That's crazy. Yeah, because I'm not going to be using the football team to get this. I was talking about Coach Brown today, actually. Coach Brown because I really think, I'm going to watch what I say, we kind of got cheated our junior and senior year because I think that Coach Brown should have still been there. And no, I think
Beck, you're right.
Yeah, and I believe if Coach Brown would have still been there, because I've seen Coach Brown got some guys in the college. I don't know how, but anyway.
Yeah.
But I believe that if Coach Brown would have still been there, a lot of our life trajectories would have been different. Or even if he would have got still in greatness, the path would have been maybe a little bit more defined. I'll say that.
And the team was on the upswing. I mean, look at how well we did our junior year, when BJ was starting quarterback, and we put Stump as the
wing. Put Stump at that wing tee. Had Stump at that outside, that running back. You know how that wing tee is. I still think that's the most stupid offices.
But I'm also imagining that also working in Coach Brown's offense with Hugh Mays and Stump. Yeah. It would have been me and Thaddeus at running back probably. Yeah. I mean, it's hindsight, of course. I mean, it's 2020, yeah. But I think we would have been just as successful that year with Coach Brown in Coach Brown's.
And he did. Shout out all the fellas. Shout out all the fat guys. Big B, Big Sam, Ralph. I saw BJ at homecoming, and it's amazing how. Like, we cannot see that right now. Like, we ain't seen each other in years. I'm talking years. Somebody hit you on Facebook. And those moments when we're talking, we automatically go back to those days outside in the grass, putting in work, everybody cussing, sweating, mad in the locker room. And that's a kinship. I tell people, even when it comes to the sports, even if you don't make it to the next level, there's a kinship that comes with those kind of activities that you take on forever.
Absolutely.
And relationships.
Absolutely. I was at BJ's house maybe 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, and we just picked right back up talking about the same stories. It was me, Rico, and Ralph Wright. Rico Johnson and Ralph Wright. And just pick up like we left off in the locker room.
That's it. I'm telling you, man, those stories you cannot beat.
Yeah.
Okay, so shout out to the Bruins. Who are the best team around here? I don't care what nobody say. Don't argue with me. Argue with your mamas and daddies. But, okay, so. All right, so being in high school, you're playing football.
Mm-hmm.
At what point did you – I'm pretty sure you was always in your academics. So at what point you start to realize, I want to go to – and what made you pick Howard? Or like
Yeah. So it goes back to 10th grade, right? Coach Carl gets unceremoniously fired. That's the upset I've most upset I've ever been.
We all cried. we all cried in the auditorium.
I remember like a bunch of football players crying.
Yes, I remember that.
But I kind of like at that point, you know, I was still on the team, but I really wasn't. I wasn't into it as much. You know.
Okay.
I started finding other interests. You know, we were also in Kappa League. That was a big part of my high school experience. Eventually, I joined DECA as well.
What's that? I don't know what that is.
Distributive Education Clubs of America.
Okay.
It was out of COVEC.
Okay.
Basically, you know, I got to see California because of DECA. I got to go on trips and stuff like. A lot of us were in it. You remember the cookies, Miss Knight cookies at COVID?
Yes.
That was that group.
Okay. I got you now.
Yeah. Anyway, there's just other things I'm starting to see. And eventually, how it happened for me is I ended up getting a high score on the PSAT. And it wasn't on purpose. Like, it just happened. And because I got a high score in the PSAT, it meant that I would be qualifying for the National Merit Scholarship. And so junior year and senior year, I'm starting to get all of these colleges hitting me up because being a Black person and National Merit Scholar, it meant that they had a ready kind of population to diversify their student bodies.
Okay.
Right. And in between this, we all go to Clemson for the summer for those 2 week SAT camps. I don't know if you heard about that before.
Yeah, that's
a big part of this too. And so I'm a senior, and you know, God rest his soul, Coach Sistrunk and Coach Justin Danner, they were on me about trying to get a football scholarship. And they wanted me to work harder. They wanted me to, you know, come into the weight room more. I can remember the conversations. And I'm also at the same time getting all this interest academically from schools, And I'm like, football is good, but football is not going to be the reason I quote unquote go to college. And, you know, unfortunately, that caused some tension and friction between me and some of the coaches, because I remember the day Coach Felder said, if you don't want to play college football, you don't need to be on this team.
I remember that.
And I'm like,
that's crazy. I remember that.
For real? And so I can just tell you, like, by the time before the season was up, senior year, I got offers from Iowa State, full ride, University of Florida, full ride, University of Tennessee, full ride. But I didn't want to go to an HWCU. I wanted to go to an HBCU. Oh. And Howard was all late. I mean, it was like into like November. And I remember it was my birthday, November 26th. And Howard sent me a package and said, all you got to do is apply and you're in with a full ride. And so that's what I did. Come to find out, Rico Johnson also got in. Josh August got in with to be the football team's long snapper.
Yep. And
of course, BJ to be quarterback at Howard, because there was a Coach Moses,
yep,
who recruited heavily from Howard. And that continued for the next several years. I mean, even some of the folks behind us, Corey Berry.
Yep.
And then Dante Martin comes later.
Yep.
And so we all decide, let's go to Howard. And that's how that basically happened. But I went on academic scholarship.
Wow.
In fact, as soon as I got there, I think BJ and them was like, man, you could make the team. I don't know. And it wasn't whether or not I could make it. There were so many other distractions at Howard University that I wanted to take advantage of. And going to football practice every day.
Ain't one of them.
Wanted to do.
I've heard.
Yeah, I had to maintain a 3.3 in order to keep my scholarship.
Okay. Was that easy for you?
No, not at first, because I was used to coasting through courses. But in college, you kind of had to study. You have to kind of put some work in.
Okay.
And so my first year, I almost lost it. I was very close. I had 3.4.
That's cool.
And then they make you start over every year. And so it has to be the yearly GPA. So you can't just be like, I got a 4.0 one year and then a 2.0 the next year. That balances out. No. You got to start it out every year. By the time I became a junior in college, I pretty much mastered how to do it. So.
Okay. So that's good. So my thing was that, so I want to rewind back a little bit. So
yeah.
You said you had an offer to Florida, an offer to Tennessee, full ride, and some other PWIs.
Yep.
First of all, what's your father study? What did your father have a doctorate in?
Computer science, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and what college did he go to for his bachelor's?
South Carolina State, of course.
South Carolina State, okay. Yeah. So do you think he probably was like, even though he might have not said it, does his influence saying like, Josh, I really would like for you to probably go to an HBCU to get the experience, or he just let you just make your own decision?
He let me make my own decision, and shout out to him for that, because
okay.
his only thing was, you know, it's your decision. It's of course better to go to a place where you have the money. That was a big consideration. My family couldn't write a check for tuition, but that wasn't going to happen. And so he supported my decision making on that one. Now the only thing was, so I did apply to state. And my dad was like, you need to apply to state. I'm like, I'm not going to state, Dad. I'm not going. But he said that he was thinking about, I remember this, he said, something might happen to you. Something might happen to the family where you need to stay close to home and you need to have this backup plan. And so I did also get a full ride to state. And they actually invited me on campus and they gave me one of those like big checks. You know, you win a lottery or something, they give you a check. So state gave me one of those. It's like, this is a lie. I'm not coming. Thank you.
God, I'm going to state. Go ahead, state. Okay. So that's great. Okay, so that's good. Your father, and shout out to you for actually being in touch. So when you go to state, I mean, it's nice to meet you. Go to Howard.
Yeah.
Do you know that you're going for African American studies, or you don't know yet?
Absolutely not. In fact, me, BJ, Rico, and Josh August were in the School of Business. Actually, Josh August might have been in architecture at first.
Okay.
I know the three of us were in the School of Business. We're thinking, like, where are we going to go to get money? Where are we going to get paid? And we didn't know any better. And so that was where, and also we were in DECA. DECA is like a marketing club. And so Rico was in DECA with me, and we were like, all right, we're going to School of Business. And so I majored in management at first. BJ majored in management too, and Rico majored in finance. That's what we thought we were going to do. But it took me a while to figure out that that wasn't what I was going to do.
Okay.
And so, yeah.
Because I seen Josh, because me and Josh actually talked one day, because Josh came home. I think Josh is, I don't know, Josh, he's not a pilot. I think he's the guy, he's the people that's in the cockpit. He stay here, go back to school for that, to tell the planes where to land at.
Air traffic control.
Yeah, traffic control. Mm-hmm. I ran to him, he told my dad, like I said, BJ, I'd love to see y'all. I'm going to say, of course, you know, everybody has their downfalls, but I'm going to say this, I could be wrong, but just seeing it as a whole, everybody kind of find their way, you know what I'm saying? In our class, even on the football team. Absolutely. Some longer than others. Mm-hmm. Everybody found their way. So at what point does African-American studies kind of come into the picture?
So I switch over. I never changed my major, but I kind of switch over in terms of interest and focus by the time I'm a junior, sophomore, between sophomore and junior years in college. So I took a class with Greg Carr, who eventually becomes my mentor, my Jegna, what we call the person who brings you forth. Okay. And so after that class, you know, business didn't make a lot of sense for me. I was interested in more relationships to community, relationships to our history, things of that nature. And I ended up going to Africa that summer. So I went to South Africa for 3 weeks with Dr. Carr, as well as with Dr. Dana Williams, who is now a dean at Howard. And that just changed my life. It changes my trajectory. And from that trip, I started to study more, started to read a lot more books. I started to engage with our tradition more intentionally. And I knew that, you know, what I was being prepared to do in business was not something that I would have been happy doing. And I also started engaging with issues around DC community, but mostly also issues on campus. And so I became a social activist at the same time. And as a consequence of all of that, I was sort of prepared to enter into graduate school in African American studies.
Wow. So your bachelor's is still is in business?
Yep, it's in finance.
In finance?
Yeah.
Okay. And look at that. See, Josh, you got one of them stories. You're supposed to be somewhere on Wall Street. You're like, nope, I'm coming. I'm going to teach my people about our people.
Yeah, I lasted maybe 5 or 6 weeks in a wealth management firm in Tysons Corner, Virginia. And it wasn't bad. It was Black owned. You know, he was doing the best that he could. The manager of that fund. But it's still, you know, it was something that I wouldn't have been happy doing it. And so that's the most important part. And so I decided to change my trajectory.
Okay. Let me tell you what I love. So you're going to have, so I almost called it like, I told somebody, let's say at least you was in college and sometimes I guess your brain wakes up. I told somebody one of the most awakening weekends of my life. And I think my brain wasn't ready for it. I watched Roots. And yes. Malcolm X in one weekend.
Oh my God.
I was going. My stepdad had to talk to me because my brain was not prepared for that kind of. That's a lot. I still say to anybody, you should watch Roots. Yeah, you should watch Malcolm X. And mm-hmm. It's very life changing, actually.
Absolutely.
So you switch. So you had this awakening and you go to the you go to South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So even with that experience, because see, we grew up in Orangeburg, so we are used to seeing us. It's common for to see us. So how does it feel like when you go to South Africa? What is that feeling? You know, I know it changed your life, but what is that feeling being in South Africa?
So I tell people all the time that it was an experience that helped me understand us better. Because being away, being so many miles away, and seeing the deep similarities between Black life in South Africa, Black life in South Carolina, Black life in the United States of America, but also like not just the circumstances, but the cultural connections and thread, it allowed me to really understand what was happening back home much better. And I tell folks this because one of the things that I want to encourage people to do is when you go abroad, immerse yourself in the communities. Don't just stay around in the tourist spots and the hotels and the go to the communities, because what you will find is that there is so much more that connects us. And it was out of that connection that I was able to understand this intellectually too, right? And so most people who start off in these kinds of journeys that I'm describing will say, well, I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, or I read Souls of Black Folk. I didn't read that first. What I read first was I Write What I Like by Steve Biko, a South African writer.
Wow.
I read, you know, A Long Walk to Freedom by Nelson Mandela, a South African. And what that did for me was it sort of allowed me to see myself through the lens of the South African experience, right? And better understand the Black American experience as a consequence. Because guess who Steve Biko was in part inspired by? Stokely Carmichael, Malcolm X, right? And so how does that work? How does that happen? They're figuring out what is shared across these national boundaries, but also what about white supremacy and what about racism allows us to see the connections across time and space. And again, these political struggles are transnational. They're happening across these national boundaries. But the other thing that's like bigger than these boundaries is our cultural connections. And so the foods that we eat, the kind of ways that we gather, our spiritual traditions. I saw all of that in South Africa and it was so familiar. In fact, one night we went to see these young kids from what we would call the hood, right? And guess what they were doing? Guess what? They were stepping. Like, I remember stepping. I know what stepping is. They just didn't call it stepping, right? And so it was the same rhythm. It was the same dance. But those types of things, that just happened over and over and over. I was there for 3 weeks. And it's happening over and over and over and over again. And then, of course, at Howard, you know, we have people from all around the Black world too. We have students from Africa, students from the Caribbean, students from pretty much all 50 states. Like, you can meet Black people from Kansas and Colorado and Idaho at Howard. It's really fascinating.
that's crazy, but that's good too. Because you know, I think probably Howard and Morehouse. And nobody from Claflin, don't jump down my neck. Claflin is a great university. But I think worldwide, I think Howard and Morehouse are probably the two most recognizable namesake HBCUs. Just namesake.
Well, so, I would say yes, but also we got to add Spelman, Tuskegee. We got to add now on North Carolina A&T. I mean, FAMU. Like, I think this is a really exciting time for HBCUs in the sense mm-hmm. that people are now putting the name out there mm-hmm. in ways that didn't happen. Because when you and I were growing up, the only time, and we lived in Orangeburg, but the only time we got national recognition was maybe if ESPN decided to show the Heritage Bowl 1 year or, right? That's but it. Now it's like, it's ubiquitous. You can turn on the TV now and see an HBCU game. And so the challenge, of course, people that work at HBCUs like me is what we do with that. What we do with this recognition, mm-hmm. what we do with this intention. Because I argue, and this is what some of the things I wrote about in my first book, We Are Worth Fighting For, is that we should be doing things a lot differently than we are right now. And I think with that attention and recognition, it might give us the opportunity to make that claim or to make that statement.
Because one thing about you that I like is, well, watch what I say. You are very vocal, even at your place of employment. I'm like, woo. Yeah.
Yes, I am. And the reason I am is because I believe our students are the most important resource in our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody is a student, right? And that's what I love about Howard. Howard has to be relatable to the community. Because just like me, right, I come from Orangeburg, South Carolina, mm-hmm. and I end up at Howard. I'm bringing the whole bird with me when I come, right?
Yep.
The idea. And even the people that physically can't come, I'm bringing their ideas, I'm bringing their, you know, culture, I'm bringing all of that. And so what that means in terms of the critique that you often see me kind of advancing is that Howard should have space for everybody else to do that too. And so when Howard says, well, you got to check that at the door, or you can't bring in all that. You can't do the Roy on the yard, right? You can't do that.
Shout out to Roy.
But there's what we call like respectability politics, right?
Yeah.
You have to change who you are in order to fit in. I'm like, no, everybody should be able to be themselves. But there's not just that. There's power in us being ourselves. There is, I think, that's progressive in the sense that it allows the full range of our humanity to be in this space too. And so my biggest critique of Howard and other HBCUs is the elitism that sort of suffuses these particular spaces that say, well, only a certain kind of Black person should have access to this, right? Or we should try and take all the Blackness out of you and put a different kind of Blackness in you so that you can be quote unquote successful. I think our community is much more complex and complicated than that, but also how does that free anybody if I have to change who I am in order to be successful?
Correct, man. I love that. So my thing is, and I'm bouncing back and forth a little bit. Let's follow. I'm going to go back to how you're going to decide to become a professor. But yeah. I have a side note with you being a professor at HBCU.
Mm-hmm.
Now I'm gonna give you. I want you to go, and we can have dialogue about this. Nobody argues HBCU football been around for hell.
Mm-hmm.
And there's always been great players. Even if you go to Darius Leonard, there's always going to be like, because when you're good, you're good. So I don't care if you're playing for Orangeburg Christian Community College. If you're great, the NFL is going to find you most likely. So there's always going to be one or two. But I honestly feel as though, and I say people in Orangeburg don't count because we don't stay here, so we might pay more attention to HBCUs than non. So, because some people on the West Coast, they don't even know what HBCUs is, really.
Right.
Even up north, some of them, unless their parents are from the South. How do you feel that, we have dialogue about this, Deion Sanders' impact was on Jackson State?
We don't know yet. And that's, I think we should wait and see. We know what the immediate impact was, which is a whole bunch of attention, right? But what will that translate into 5-10 years down the line? We just don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I appreciate how much conversation and dialogue this has produced. And for those who are taking that seriously, I think that's a great move, right? Like, we have to take seriously what his presence meant. But we really can't say in terms of what the impact would be until probably 5-7 years down the line. But I do think that I have a special place in my heart for Southern public HBCUs, because my parents, of course, went to South Carolina State.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of those institutions like FAMU, North Carolina A&T, Tennessee State, Jackson State, Southern, Grambling mm-hmm. State, Alabama A&M, Alabama State, so on and so forth. They do a great job of bringing in what I would call the least of these, right? Mm-hmm. People who have been discarded or saying that they can't have a college education over the arc of their entire existence, right?
Right.
I mean, these are institutions that are educating people who are walking out of slavery. And we have to understand what that means.
Correct.
Right? In America, you're not supposed to do that, right? Most people who are in college at that time, at the turn of the 19th century, are already members of the elite. Yeah. So HBCUs, they're taking people who are literally a generation removed from slavery, two generations removed from slavery, and they're saying, we're going to give you the same kind of education.
Correct.
So to the extent that we forget that that's the purpose, which is possible when you center athletics too much, then it becomes a problem for me, right? And so I think one of the things that Jackson State, the Jackson State saga shows us is how under-resourced we all are in terms of HBCUs.
This is
The contradictions that Deion exposed is a question of resources. And that's because those Southern state legislatures are starving us, right? Those Republican-dominated state legislatures, they don't want to see people like Travis Hunter educated.
At our schools. They don't mind coming to – he can go to Georgia now.
And if he went to Georgia, they wouldn't care if you went to a single class as long as you remained eligible.
Yep. They would not care because I actually feel as though – I told somebody, I actually feel as though I appreciate Deion. I love it, but and like somebody else said, to be fair, because Deion actually, he's probably the only coach I've ever seen. He came in and he brought resources. He's the only coach I've ever seen that he brought sponsors and Walmarts and stuff. But my thing is, man, they ain't number one Deion.
Deion is a
anomaly by itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes I think in order for people to be like, well, because he set the blueprint now, but Deion is Deion. It ain't too many.
Which is why I think you have to fight it at the political level. You can't just hope for a celebrity hire to come save us. Like, we have to figure out how to make education a significant part of what these state legislatures fund and do it on our own terms, because when you look at, you know, what happened historically, right? Sacramento State is a great example. It's because Thomas Miller was a politician, right? During the Reconstruction era, period, right? And they are forcing, and Claflin too, right? Claflin was a state-supported institution at one point. So they are forcing, you know, these legislatures to center education. You know, one thing that I tell, you know, students all the time, or remind students all the time, especially ones from the South, is that our ancestors valued education so much that we are the ones that mandated public schools in the South. Black people. There was no real public school system before the Civil War in the South. And so we walk out of slavery, we get political, we gain political office, and the first, one of the first things that we do is we have to construct a public school system. And so what is it about the power of education that our ancestors knew that we sometimes forget, unfortunately?
I think we just get very slack. I was reading, because somebody judged me, because they said, you the most reading this chain wearing boy I know. Because I love the, I said, don't judge me now. Don't judge me. Because I was reading the book on Booker T. Washington.
Okay.
His biography.
Yeah.
It tripped me out because the only thing I really know about Booker T. Washington before is just him and W.E. Du Bois and all of the different, well, today we would call it trade school versus just strictly education, this book education. Mm-hmm. But I told somebody, after reading that book, this man made me take a lot of excuses. This man was born a slave in West Virginia, and to think that 20 years later, he has founded an institution.
Right. Right.
He was literally born a slave.
Yes.
He was born a slave, and then 20 years later, 20 some years, he went to, because this, I think he said he went to Howard.
He went to Hampton.
Hampton.
Mm-hmm.
He worked to pay for tuition.
Yeah. Yeah.
He worked at the college. I'm like, wait a minute. This man could not read it right. But also, I think he's right here too.
He told his tuition.
Yep.
He was a janitor.
And did not complain and did it. But it's my thing with that. Also, do you feel as though, because even back then, even look at some of the lawyers, even like in the 70s and 80s, like I almost say 70s, 80s, like I say 60s, when they made it so easy for, so like, cause like you can even like a lot of these wealthy guys, like billionaires,
mm-hmm.
I realized they went straight from like the army, just went straight to college without no test. Do you think sometimes there's too many barriers to entry?
Absolutely. There are more now. They're more now. Like, I would not want to be a high school senior right now. It's highly competitive. I think the North Carolina A&T just dropped their numbers because decision day was like Friday, I think. And they announced, I have to confirm this, but I think 40,000 people applied to North Carolina A&T this year. 3,000 got in.
God, don't.
And so, yeah, it's super, super competitive. And we have to figure out, because what competition is it about now? Less about the quality education and more about the clout that you can get from having a degree from a student. Right? And so they're selling, colleges are actually actively selling this, which is why part of what I said earlier, we have to change how we frame education and why we are developing educational institutions. And so in that sense, one of the things that I wholeheartedly agree with is colleges not requiring SATs, for instance, right? Colleges having slots for people from what we would call socioeconomically disadvantaged communities, right? Making sure that we do the job of equaling the playing field, because we know that despite the fact that we created public education, we don't control it anymore. And there's a vast inequality in the education system. We from Orangeburg, we know that well, right? So just as you said earlier, all of our friends were brilliant, right? In their own way, but not all of us were able to go to the next level. Why is that? It's not because they did anything wrong, right? That's not the reason. There are actually, as you say, there are barriers that are in place, because if you say everybody can come, if you say everybody should have access, then what does it say to the people who then get the degree at the end? You're less special now, right? So there's and colleges love that, right? Colleges love being exclusive, right? They love saying that we have the best and the brightest. But as you said earlier, we all are bright. And so we should all have access. That's my argument at least. And it should be free.
I love that, and guys, I love this because this is actually coming from a professor.
Yeah.
Okay. Now we got that. I appreciate you for saying that. I'm just gonna say something, y'all. He's very vocal about his universe, as he should be. But that's how you know he really cares. Okay. So now I'm gonna go back. So you go to graduate school. You go to graduate school. When you go to graduate school and African American studies, do you still know that I just want to do it and see where it go, or now you thinking like I'm going to be in education. I'm going to know a level.
Yeah, so I kind of went to kind of camp out for 2 years because when I graduated from college in 2009, that was the financial crisis, the real bad ones with the subprime mortgage loans and stuff like that. And so I had friends who were losing their jobs before they started them during that period. So it was difficult. What I really wanted to do was to be a full-time activist, but you could not pay your bills or get a job being a full-time activist during that particular era.
Okay.
And unless you wanted to join like nonprofit world, which I didn't really want to join. In fact, that's probably still the case.
Why not?
Well, nonprofits spend a whole lot of time dealing with bureaucracy. It's almost like working a corporate job at this point.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really bad. And there's some important outliers, but for the most part, right? That's what it feels like. And I didn't want to do that. And so I had two really close friends that I consider sisters. My friends Ava and Courtney were already in grad school, and they said, just come to grad school. And so I applied like with 1 month left before the application was due. And I got in and I decided, well, I'm just going to stay for the master's. Well, when I get there, my advisor, Dr. Nathaniel Norman, says, you're going to stay for the PhD. You're going to go through. And he essentially gave me two things. He gave me a research assignment for his own book. And so I was doing research immediately. And then the second thing that he did is he gave me my own class to teach after my second year. And so I was in the classroom teaching my first class alone at the age of 23 years old. College professor. It was difficult, brother. It was difficult because teaching is hard, first of all, but as someone who was that close in age to the students and also a grad student at the same time, and you're there alone, it was very, very difficult to kind of bring those students in as well as get the experience that I needed. And so it's interesting, Orangeburg is everywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
That first class that I taught as a grad student, there's a brother from Orangeburg in the class.
Good Lord.
Yeah, Rachel Green's brother. I think his name was, his name was Thomas.
Yeah. I knew talking about, I forgot his name.
Yeah. And so it's crazy, right? And so I'm sitting here overwhelmed. Like, I don't know if I can do this. I'm teaching a class for the first time. And he raises his hand and says, "You're from Orangeburg, right?" This is at Temple University in Philly.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's what happened. And so that first class, it was difficult. But by the time I got to the next semester, I started getting into the swing of things. And what's interesting about this is that 12 years later, what I realized is that every semester is going to be a unique challenge because students change a lot. And, you know, about to age everybody. But my freshmen this year, they were born in like 2004, 2005. So yeah, it's weird. Imagine that, right? And so, I mean, there's certain references that I can't even make. I can't reference Allen Iverson in class or Jay-Z. That doesn't mean anything to them.
It don't mean nothing.
Yeah, it's crazy. In fact, Sequoia Justin, our other teammate, he's in D.C. right now, and tomorrow I'm going to give his son a tour of Howard.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah.
We up there, man. Like, so it's like that's how much students and their experiences differ and change over time. And so if you want to reach them, you have to be able to adapt. I can't teach the same way I taught in 2012. It's not going to work.
These kids are so much different. So it's crazy, Josh. Because really, I guess that's how God works. You didn't chose to be a teacher. Your professor, he chose for you to be a teacher.
Essentially.
Yeah.
So they saw things in me that I didn't see, and also my two sisters, right? They saw things in me that I didn't see for myself. Because all I was doing up until that point was maybe doing a little writing, right?
Okay.
I hadn't done any teaching. I hadn't done any research. Just a little editorializing and writing, right? And so I got my research legs under me at the same time that I got my teaching legs under me. And then 2 years later, I'm getting a PhD.
You get a PhD doctor. Okay, so now also I'm going to talk about this right here, too. Shout out to my partner, QI. So him and his lovely wife on the picture. That's a crazy picture to have on the thing, though. But speaking of writing,
yeah.
So I'm looking at you. I'm looking. So what happens with? You probably do these research papers. So what happens when you be like, you know what? I think I want to write me a book. Your first book.
Yes. Well, there's several things that are happening.
Okay.
And so in order to get a PhD, you have to write a dissertation. Okay. And I wrote a dissertation first, and that was like the first long thing that I ever wrote. And it took, you know, a couple years to really do it. But it gave me confidence, right, that I could do something long form. And so the other thing about being in Philly, though, is there's like the Orangeburg like network and there's the Howard network.
Okay.
So the Howard network put me in touch with people that had gone to Howard years before. Okay. And it was important because, you know, I was in Philly, you know, for 4 years and it was kind of like being away from home twice removed. I'm away from what became my home in DC, but I'm also away from home in South Carolina. And so I needed people. And one of the people that I needed was a sister by the name of Akanke Washington. And she became an important person in my life, but she also was a Howard grad. And she had participated in a protest in 1989. And, you know, 25 years after that protest, I came back to teach at Howard. and she decided that they wanted to do an event on 25th anniversary, and I helped put the event together on campus. And then after the event, they were like, can you write something? It's like, okay, I can write something. And then I wrote it. And then after I wrote it, they were like, can you write a book?
Yeah.
And so that's a short part. That's a short version. And so that book project came as a result of the relationships that I had with people. It's not something that I chose for myself in many ways, but they trusted me with that project. And so I told the story of the protest from their perspective. And so that was the first book, and that's how that came to be. But it aligns because in order to get tenure in the academy, you have to have publications, right?
Oh.
And so that book became part of my case for earning tenure at Howard.
What? So, and you had tenure at what age? What age when you got tenure?
Let me think for a second. So I got tenure in 2020. It was like that crazy year, 2020.
Okay.
So that means I was 35, 34, 35, somewhere in there.
Is that common to get tenure? Because to me, this viewing you through Facebook, it seemed like, once you hit your stride, it's like bam, teacher, bam, book, bam, doctorate, bam, tenure. So, like, is that common, or are you pretty much you like one of the younger people that get tenured at Howard?
I'm probably not the youngest ever.
Okay,
but it's certainly not. I'm not the average age. I think most people probably will get tenure in their 40s, maybe. But here's the thing, like I went straight through. I went straight through. I didn't take any years off. So I finished undergrad, went straight to grad school, got my PhD, and then came straight back to the workforce. And so most people will work for 6 years on probationary status.
Mm-hmm.
They get tenure. And so by the time I did all of that, I was still relatively young. But I know of people who've gotten tenure in their 20s before, so it's not like
okay,
yeah.
So even with that, my question with that is, so you write the book, you do your thing, you're doing your thing. So I'm gonna tell you something. God loves you because like you ain't got to think. God just pushes you in the direction you're supposed to go. Like you, like, I don't know. I got you. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Be like, hey, I need you to write a story. Since you disagreed on that, go ahead and please want you to go ahead and do a book. So
yeah.
You publish a book. And so what goes along with writing the second book? And what's the title of the second book?
It's a similar kind of story. So the second book is a biography of Cedric Robinson.
Okay.
And Cedric Robinson was like this hugely important figure in terms of like Black studies. He was one of the first Black studies scholars, but he's so much more than that. That was what the book talks about. But he was important for me because you described it as an awakening earlier. When that was happening, he was one of the writers that I would eventually gravitate towards.
Okay.
And so I only ended up meeting him once. He was out in California, and so he rarely, as an elder, I made it to the East Coast. And so I saw that he was coming to New York in like 2014. And I kind of dropped everything to go meet him because I don't know if that was ever going to be. And it ended up being the only time that I met him. And okay. He passed away 2 years later. In either case, a big part of the dissertation kind of grappled with one of his major ideas, which is like the Black radical tradition.
Okay.
And what that means is that, you know, Black people as a community, as a people, and not just Black Americans, but Black people all across Brazil, Cuba,
mm-hmm.
Mexico, wherever we found Black people, resisted slavery on their own terms, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's more resistance than there's not resistance. Now people be like,
they don't tell that story.
right. Now people be like, if it was me, I would have fought that. And I was like, yeah. We did fight back. So he helped me understand that story, in other words. his conceptually. And so what happened was most people take their dissertation and mm-hmm. make it to their first book. That's generally what happens. Well, not most people, a lot of people. And so I thought I was going to do that, but I realized my dissertation wasn't ready yet.
Okay.
So I reformed the book. I made it into a different format. And there ended up being a chapter on Cedric Robinson because he's so important to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I sent that chapter to one of his students, a really important writer, historian by the name of Robin D.G. Kelly.
Okay.
And Kelly really liked the piece, which is like a big win for me because this is Robin D.G. Kelly. He's like, not only did he read it, he liked it. Oh, my God.
Yes.
This would be like a young coach sending tape to Deion Sanders. I'm like,
I got you.
And so that happened. I was like, oh, this is good. And so when Kelly saw it, Kelly then recommended me to write a full book on Cedric Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I got my second book.
I love that because I'm going to have to, because I'm not going to lie, because in the past, I'm going to say maybe, well, I'm going to say 4 or 5 years, I've become more intent on my studies and like other stuff like about like Dr. Ben and different listening to different people talking Dr. Ben and what's the other one? I even like the poet that's there.
You said the poet?
Yeah, he's like a poet.
Amir Baraka?
No. He was I'm trying to watch what I say. I don't want to miss words. He was like in the 60s and 70s. He had a book called I'm Not Your Negro.
Oh, James Baldwin.
James Baldwin. Because even I went down that rabbit hole and started listening to stuff. And that's when I found out, like, even with Denmark on Beach, I'm like, there's more people fight that they'll talk about. But when you talk about that, that does not fit the narrative. That's why I think that does not fit the narrative that people want to be broadcasted. But I think African-American studies are so important because, but what I'm telling you, I don't like, and you might just speak to this, but you're a little bit more well-read.
Mm-hmm.
It was so much that I did not know until I went to OC Tech and I ended up going to college and I took some African-American classes. That I'm like, why didn't we learn this back in the fifth grade?
Right.
Some people should have been taught in fifth grade. This didn't even had not been a big deal. And I think you taught that in the fifth grade, that would change so many kids' lives.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I 100% agree. Even the Orangeburg Massacre, we learned a little bit about it. Maybe middle school, high school.
Yep.
But it was only when I got to Howard that I realized how huge that moment was for the whole country.
Yes.
For instance, Howard students, when they saw what happened with the police in Orangeburg, they turned up on Howard. and they submitted this document to Howard's administration called the Orangeburg Ultimatum.
And wow. Said,
if you don't give us these demands, we're going to take over the A building. And they did. And it's because Orangeburg, right? And so, like, I wish I had that information. When I was living in Orangeburg, and you know, every now and then, I learned little things, which are big things.
Yes.
About what was happening in Orangeburg, for instance, Orangeburg was the largest cotton producer in the state right after slavery, which helps us understand why there's so many Black people in Orangeburg County. Right, in terms of the dominant population.
I just learned something new. I did not know that.
Yeah, right. And so, and it's very different. South Carolina, you know, was dominated by rice production, right? Which we always eat rice.
whatever meal.
Charleston County, Beaufort County, Colleton County, Jasper County, that whole area dominated by rice production in the 1700s, the 1800s. But then cotton takes over, and that's when the Midlands kind of rises out of that, right? And yeah. Orangeburg is at the center. Orangeburg is extremely wealthy. We don't think about Orangeburg as well. in terms of the exploitation of cotton, right? But I also think that's why people in black fucking Orange Bay got a chip on their shoulder.
Yeah, that's a lot.
And you know, I was reading this book called Shrill Hurrahs, which talks about gendered violence, the violence against women in the state. And there's like this line in the book, you know where Hillcrest and the tracks are?
Yeah.
There was a lynching on Rough Road in Orangeburg in the 1800s. But guess what happened the next month?
What happened?
Black folk from Cannon Bridge Road. It's like crazy, right? Planned a revolt.
Wow.
And so nobody's written about this. And in fact, even the book that I'm talking about, they didn't really write about it. They just referenced it. And so there's like all of these stories that we need to tell that are really localized as well, right? There's so much happening in Orangeburg County that, you know, if I had the time, I would go back and do the research myself. But, you know, I'm going to probably end up training somebody from Orangeburg to go and look at it, because this stuff is just sitting in libraries and wait for somebody to articulate it. And then maybe if somebody writes the book, somebody can do a movie on it or somebody can do a play on it and kind of bring these histories together. We do a good job about Orangeburg in the 50s and 60s, right? Gloria Blackwell and the Orangeburg Freedom Movement, right?
Yeah.
Gil Scott Heron's ex-wife is Gloria Blackwell's daughter.
Yeah.
She protests in Orangeburg County Courthouse at the age of like 14 years old. Like all of these stories, the Claflin Movement, right? Nerds. And then, of course, leading to the Orangeburg Massacre. But things are happening the whole time. There's a poet who lives in Oakland, by the name of Adam David Miller, and he has a book called Ticket to Exile. And in that book, he talks about how he grew up in Orangeburg. He grew up around, I want to say Magnolia, but very, very close to campus.
Okay. He grew up on the hill, probably.
I don't know. I have to get the exact address.
Okay. But
the address is important because he could walk to his job. He worked in a white person's shoe shop. And he's like 12, maybe 11 or 12. And he doesn't know yet the racial code that he has to abide by at that age. Yeah. And a white girl walks into the shoe shop that he's working in. And he writes her a little note. And the note was very simple. It said something like, "I would like to get to know you better." The girl takes the note home to her mom, and a lynching party automatically emerges. They have to secretly ship him up north because he wrote this note at the age of 12, right? An innocent childhood desire, right? And he ends up never coming back to Orangeburg.
That could have been Emmett Till.
It could have, right? It's the same exact thing, right? And you know, this is he ends up becoming this renowned poet, Adam David Miller, the poet, but this is his story of how he became that. He had to be kicked out of Orangeburg.
To be great. Or ran out to be great. Jesus. Man, so
that are awaiting us.
That's crazy. And I'm gonna tell you what else I think that is so funny is even like an underlying story. Even with the Orangeburg Massacre, the fact that Strom Thurmond's illegitimate daughter was there, he had Secret Service go pick her up from state, and that's a big story. Everybody like that didn't even happen. Like, even though they didn't talk about it, it's almost like in the week I saw her interview because she promised him. She like, "No, I caught him ready, and he was there the whole entire time. It was not a secret. My mama was there. He took care of us." But even think that. We think about how crazy this is, even when it comes to the race. Strom Thurmond was in our history books for being a racist bigot, and he was still alive in office when we were still in school. He was in the books.
He sure was being
a racist bigot, and still was in office. And he could barely even speak, but they still would have let him. He's still in office. Now that's crazy.
Absolutely. And in fact, I remember growing up seeing him on TV.
Yes.
like, you know, this is benign figure. He's harmless old guy. Then I realized he's the architect of Jim Crow. But I realized that once I got to college, and people would say, "Oh, your friend's like, oh, Strom Thurmond, right?" And in fact, the other thing I have to say this because in the first book, the reason that they protested is because Strom Thurmond's protege got selected to go to Howard's Board of Trustees. Lee Atwater, who is also from South Carolina, from Aiken, but he's the architect of the racist campaigns of George H.W. Bush in the 1980s. South Carolina.
He got elected to the... I'm going to tell you, while we on this, and you can speak to it as freely as you want to or not as freely as you want to.
Mm-hmm.
I had a conversation with somebody else about... They stay at university because I know one day my podcast is going to be all over the world and they're going to, I want to come back and find this clip. But I'm just going to speak very generally.
Uh-huh.
If you look at these, I look at these boards like if you look at like a board like South Carolina board.
Right.
Like, South Carolina board. Sometimes, University of South Carolina, you'd be one of, it'd be like Oprah Winfrey, Tyler Perry. Mm-hmm. I think her name is Donna Moore. I think she might be a billionaire. Or she just multi million dollars. And you see all these names,
mm-hmm.
and it'd be like really, really wealthy people. This is time I look at schools are always having money issues.
Mm-hmm.
I look at these names, and this time these people be very, like I said, they could be do okay in their own route, doing okay in their own. Field, whatever that field is, but they're not necessarily extremely successful. So my thing is, and I think you speak or not speak this to one thing. I think that's how a lot of money get missing. I think we have people that are not used to seeing $1 million. Because to be honest with you, the board of trustees has access to that school money, mm-hmm. and sometimes school money seems to often goes missing, or funds seem to disappear, or funds are not. I don't know. It's just not working right. So you think sometimes like. We need to have people. It'll be better if you have more people like, they might be turning it down too, but like more people who really know about finances.
Well, boards are complex things, and usually they don't necessarily have a direct hand in the governance of the university. However, they have a direct influence.
Okay.
Right. In other words, they don't got access to the bank account, but they do have access to people who make decisions about where the money goes, right?
Okay. For instance,
you know, the board, they would say they have a fiduciary responsibility for the financial health of the university. And at the same time, the board can also say, well, I work for PepsiCo, so therefore, South Carolina State, you're going to have Pepsi products on campus.
Okay.
That's where that comes in, right? It's corruption, but it's corruption light because it's not technically illegal.
That's fair.
But those are the type of things that happens. But I think what also is happening is that when you see financial mismanagement, which of course is not, you know, unique to just HBCUs. I think, you know, you go to the Ivies, they're doing the same thing in terms of mismanaging these funds. A lot of it is...
But they're money different, Josh.
The money is different, but there are also people stealing money there too. That's my point. Right? It's vastly different.
Yeah.
But, you know, the notion that what I'm trying to address is the notion that HBCUs are uniquely corrupt. And it's like, no, higher education is corrupt.
Okay. I think that. Because my mind is blown. Yeah. I was listening to Malcolm Gladwell podcast. He did a podcast on endowments.
Right. Yeah.
It blew my mind to hear the numbers.
Yeah, slavery.
Right.
Yeah.
And he said it was a billionaire. And I forgot what small town he was in, like a town like I'm gonna just say Cleveland. I don't think it was Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
He said he could have gave. And he said he told his millionaire friend, he said, "Y'all are stupid. Why are y'all giving Ohio State $20 million?" He said he was driving by his small community college,
mm-hmm.
went to the director, who's over the school,
president,
went to the president and said, how much would it cost to start an engineering program, and I want to hear my name in the building.
Right.
The president gave him a number.
Yeah.
And he said, okay. And he figured out, he said, I really have, he said, I'll have more of an impact. My $30 million have more of an impact here, direct impact,
mm-hmm.
versus me giving $30 million, which is going to go straight to an endowment just so they can keep investing and making money. Right. They might put some out there, and that's all it is.
And this is the model that's leading to a lot of universities turning towards financial, private financial sector, and neglecting the idea that it should be the government that's funding us.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so everybody's not going, you know, and this is the whole controversy with Howard, because Howard is being seen as getting all of the money when it should be other HBCUs getting the money. And that's because these billionaires, these donors, they don't understand the name Jackson State University and how that name is huge in Jackson.
They don't. They don't.
You understand, oh, Thurgood Marshall went to Howard. Let's give the money to them. Right. Yes. And so
Puff Daddy.
Be reliant. We shouldn't be relying on any of it, right?
Correct.
We should be relying, or we should be pushing the federal government. Because so what happens is, before like 1980 or so, the vast majority of the funding for our institutions came from the federal government.
Okay.
And that changes, and it hurts the HBCUs first, mm-hmm. because that's where, even though it was still unequal, but that's, you could rely on that money coming in.
Yeah.
And that's really what happens. And now you have more inequality because of that. And so the solution isn't to beg, you know, Jeff Bezos' ex-wife for money. Mm-hmm. That's not the solution, which is what we're doing.
She gets some, the Clapton, I don't know about state, but she definitely gets in the Clapton, because Clapton is starting to build their resume of like being that next HBCU like namesake. Another thing, you being an HBCU grad, not HBCU professor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I want you to speak to this. Do you feel as though, and I think, and the school might could do more with this, that the student body, even alumni, does not give back?
You have to understand that Black giving is related to Black people's experiences in this country.
Uh-huh.
Right. In other words, look at Black people's economic health. And okay. That's the reason that the giving doesn't necessarily correspond to giving in other institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't expect people whose medium income is what it is to then also have an outsize, right? Like, you know, all of us, the vast majority of us, you know, if we miss two paychecks, we're in trouble.
You're in trouble. But do you think, but do they have like a thing where like, I don't know, you might just speak to this. I say if it's something like, I even use that, this is gonna be a stream example in my buddies, they find this funny. Like Dr. Umar Johnson. Shout out Dr. Umar Johnson. But like for instance, him, he'd be like, hey, I don't know if the school has a cash app, but like, hey, because I think sometimes we can be embarrassed. Like all I can give is $20. Mm-hmm. I can't give a check for $10,000.
Right.
But I think even though it sounds like pitching, like extra for pennies, I think at school they'd be like, hey guys, we got $20, that's fine. We have this thing set up to where you only can give 10.
Yeah, I think
$10, you can give that.
I think most institutions do have that infrastructure. I remember maybe 5 or 6 years ago when Bennett College in Greensboro was almost at the precipice of closing, that I was shooting the money, you know, monthly, because they had it set up where you do like an automatic debit from your account.
Yeah.
But I think it wasn't it wasn't a large sum. It was what I could give. And I think many institutions are now adopting that.
Okay.
It's not as streamlined as, you know, having PayPal, being PayPal ready or.
Yeah.
Ready. But I think, you know, they're getting to that point. I think that's in a conversation. I do believe that we should support our institutions, right? I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that. I think part of what that looks like is making it, like you say, naturalizing it to a degree. Like,
mm-hmm.
we pay Netflix every month. We pay...
Yeah.
how many automatic debits to your account do you have?
A lot. Just keep it small. So like, I think people get you get overwhelmed if like you see me with all the course in life gets to that point, and I go to Sacramento State and I have a big check for $30,000. My friend might be like, well, they won't need my little $100 because Marvin is getting paid a tip of $100, which is not true. You can still give. You still should be, and almost it'll make it feel good even to be able to give that. So it's not the HBCUs, because I was I think I'm gonna end up going back and I'm going to make sure I get my finish, get my bachelor's from it. Well, I say that, but we'll see what God says.
Yeah,
I might just keep on grinding. I get me a doctorate degree, honorary doctor from somewhere, honorary doctor. I'm not writing a dissertation, honorary doctor from somewhere. I just and he had his podcast get successful. But I love it, man. So for people who want to get the book, where can they go to get the book?
The easiest place to get my books is my website, joshmmyers.com, and there's a / for writing.
Okay, guys, and I'm gonna make sure that by the time this is up, guys, it's going to be in the link. It's going to be in the link. You can hit it. But say it one more time, Josh.
joshmmyers.com/writing. And there's also a link. There are links to my other interviews about the books on my website if you're kind of still on the fence and maybe want to hear more. But there's a whole lot on my website around, you know, some of the writing that I've done.
Man, because you are a writer, man. When I read the bio, I'm gonna tell y'all, shout out to my other people I've been on, all my guests been on. Josh, my first guest with a real life bio, like a bio, like a real bio.
So they make you one when you become a writer. So
yeah. But I like it though, because when I see it, it just makes me smile. And it really made me smile. I'm like, man, you know what? I just love to see these books, and like, I love to see how people. Well, we all be an intellectual, and we like I said, we all black people. I hate when we get put in a group. We all are different. We're not a monolith. We all different things and educated to this and that. Because somebody, and like we talked earlier this podcast, we're talking about Jay Green. Shout out Jay Green, brother. Hope you do your time, get free. You get free. Free Jay Green. But like, and guess what? He still is a good guy. He just something happened. We just did it today. But he's still great, and that brother's gonna better his life and better his life. But man, I tell you what, Josh, man, and like the sister of the thing said, man, this is I'm getting Black History on Easter Sunday.
Let me just give you one more shout out. Kevin Raspberry. You know that brother?
No.
He's from Orangeburg. He's written a book called The Berg. Orangeburg Black History.
I have not read the book, but I've seen the book.
Okay.
I need to get that book. Kevin Raspberry, The Berg.
Yeah. So it's basically biographies of prominent black people from Orangeburg. It's a collection of biographies.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, that's what I'm saying. Like, but why don't I know that?
Right. Right. Now you should definitely get him, and maybe even have him on.
Okay, but that's the stuff that upsets me. Like, yeah. Now shout out to the brother. I know the brother that got to search the bird. Shout out to Slim. yeah. But like,
I got one.
Yeah. Shout out to the brother that got to search the bird. But yeah. But see, that's the kind of stuff. That's why I have a daughter's 15. I have a little man that's 9. And I'd be on him so hard, and I'd say some things. He'd be like, "Dad, I didn't know that." Because I'm like, man, I'm like, this next generation, and I said, you don't got no excuse, son, because they got their things in their hand called a them phones, and they can research, mm-hmm. research, and they can get it with no problem.
Yeah.
But, man, but Josh, I want to thank you for coming on, brother.
Thank you for having me, man. This is wonderful.
I don't think you can put on, brother. Like you said, hey, we all trying to do great. And I tell somebody, I can't help it. The bird just so great. I can just do interviews just on the bird, and it just be different everywhere.
Yes.
Just the different people with the different avenues of life that they're walking.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Hey, guys, episode 91. Before we leave, Josh, can you give them that website one more time? The people in here.
So it's Josh, Joshm, second M. YERS.com.
Okay. Hey, guys, I want to thank you for tuning in to episode 91. This was great with Dr. Josh Myers, guys. There's two great books. You guys see that up above? Looking, it's the link is in there. Hit the link, go purchase the book, because I'm definitely about to get mine today. We got to show love, guys. We got to push this burglar. We got to push this burglar agenda, guys. You guys see what's going on. We taking over, guys, and we are not what they say they are. We are what we want to be. All right, guys.
Before we go, because my publisher might see this.
Okay. Oh.
The third book came out 2 months ago.
Wait a minute. Okay. Hold on. Okay. Nah. I can't even interview right now. We're not gonna do that. Hold on.
Yeah. So it's three now.
So you just wrote that. Well, I almost called you a word just now. That probably wouldn't have been the best word if we had all this black inspiration on talk. So, brother, you mean it? So you got three books out now.
Yes.
At the age of 35. You and me, are you
36.
You got three books at the age of 36. So what is this last book about?
The last one is actually the revision of my dissertation that I talked about. So it's about what Black Studies is. The idea of Black Studies.
Man, this guy don't stop. So, just a side note. I don't want to end it right now. Since you did that to me, I don't want it right now. Because the way you have you ever thought about? I don't know. Have you ever seen the show? Because I'm not gonna lie. Even though this show might have some characters that are very questionable, it also led me down the road of Black Studies. Mm-hmm. Sinetta.
Yeah, I know Sinetta.
Sinetta TV. Have you ever thought about how do you feel about some of those brothers? How do you feel about that? That intellectual sparring. Mm-hmm. That's a better word for it.
Well, so it's important because you mentioned Dr. Ben earlier, and
yep.
I'm connected to many of the same networks that knew Dr. Ben. In fact, I'm a member of an organization that Dr. Ben founded.
Okay.
Association for the Study of Classical African Civilizations, ASCAC. And so there's a very real importance to that tradition. It goes back to the whole Harlem and also Chicago stepladder tradition, where people would be on the streets giving talks and giving lectures and having engaging people. What you see with Sinetta is that's transitioned to the digital age. And there's a lot that is good that comes out of it. There's a lot that's problematic that comes out of it, but that's everything that we've created, right? And so I think, to the extent that that's pushing people to read and engage ideas, particularly about African history, who would not have otherwise been engaging it, all power to it. All power to those brothers.
I'll tell you, because it's because of that show who I know who Dr. Ben is.
And that's my point.
Yeah. When I went down his timeline, I'm like, man, this guy. Then when I found out about Professor Smalls, Ben Smalls,
yeah,
guess where he's from? South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like,
mm-hmm.
Man, when I went down there, I was like, what? And then also,
Chancellor Williams is from South Carolina. John G. Jackson is from South Carolina. These are all peoples that would have been in the generation before Dr. Ben. But they all migrated to New York too.
Yeah.
And so yeah, all of those. Yes, yeah, we can go all day. But that's really where I think it's important because, where else will people be able to get this information, right? Okay. I can tell you, a lot of us ain't even talking about Dr. Ben in college, right? So yeah, it's important.
Because what wasn't he a professor at Harvard or Yale?
Dr. Ben was at Cornell.
Cornell.
You know, he was really, really, really in Harlem in the streets.
Okay.
And so, yeah.
Man, this Negro got three books.
I met Dr. Ben in 2012 or so, 2013.
Wow.
He was very in his 90s.
Okay.
We brought him to Howard. And I think within 2 years, maybe, he made his transition. And I was actually at his funeral. Yeah.
Wow. Man, so it's not to me. I think that the next person is going to be like, hey, I know Josh Mine. Yeah, he's actually from one person like him.
Man, yeah. I hope so.
So even with that, even with your, or you got your, man, bro, you got three books out, bro. ain't gonna lie, bro. I got a committee, bro. You got three books out, bro. So, have you ever, how do you feel that, is that style of sparring, is that something that you were eventually going to, or you really just be more just on the educational side of things?
I'm in my lane. That's my lane. Is the classroom.
And, okay.
You know, again, I know those cats, and so when you see them, you also see the same networks and communities that I'm connected to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Man, y'all, okay. We went into this time, but Lord, man, this guy, man, we about to end the interview, y'all. And this man tell me, oh, by the way, I just dropped another book 2 months ago.
What?
That's a microphone drop there. But now, guys, we gotta get our three books. But Josh, man, I really appreciate it.
I'm gonna give a talk in Orangeburg. So I gave a talk at my church at Greater Faith in 2021. But I'm gonna come to Claflin Estate and give a talk.
I didn't know that. Hey, I tell you what, bro, when you come to Claflin Estate, please let me know. And please let me know so I can definitely share and we can have people come. Because when you came to Greater Faith, I didn't know.
Right.
Because I love seeing like because you know the closest I can get to those kind of like because like I said, Malcolm Gladwell is my favorite author. So okay. Like if he's doing something. But him, I probably got to travel because he's not – every now and then he might come to Charleston. I'll go hear him speak because I love his books. But because it's a different – it opens up your mind and it's a different audience and it's a different language than when you get around just intellectual talking. It kind of it makes your brain – there's a shift in the brain.
Yeah.
We're just shifting the brain. So we definitely going to check you out, man. When you come – I definitely know because people are becoming more awakened. I'll say that. I think now, if you'd have had the same conversation 15 years ago, I don't think it would be as well received.
Where. And I got some really important friends that are working at Claflin. Maybe you can connect Robert Green, Catherine Adams, Andre okay. E. Now they live in Columbia, probably. Okay. They're in the African American Studies department over at Claflin, and they're doing some really important work over there too.
Okay, well, that's what definitely connect me because I'm sharing my audience. My audience is very diverse. But definitely, I would love the connections, and we definitely can build from that because I love that kind of talk. I caught them off. I be catching them off guard. They be sleeping. I'm like, hey, how you know that? Don't worry about that. Don't worry about that, brother. Well, again. Josh, I want to appreciate you for coming on, man. Episode 91, guys. Hit that like, hit that share. Like I say, go support. Hit the link up top for the books. Go support. Show love. We'll buy a t-shirt, so that's buy a book. Hello, guys. We'll buy a t-shirt, so that's buy a book. And I know y'all felt that. Just like that, Josh. Josh, don't hang up. Just like that, guys. We out. Episode 91.